From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. The Democratic choice for the White House nominee is still too close to call. Senator Barack Obama has won more states and delegates. Senator Hillary Clinton won big states, including New York, California, and Texas. Both candidates are fighting hard to win in Pennsylvania next month. But there are still questions about voting patterns in some Harlem and Brooklyn voting districts. In these predominantly black districts, polls showed Obama initially didn't get any votes in some of the precincts. Later in the conversation, we'll talk to a Harlem voter who'll tell us about her voting experience. First up, we're speaking with Sam Roberts, urban affairs correspondent for the New York Times. Welcome.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing great. So you wrote a story that ran the day after the New York primary in mid-February. There were initial allegations of voter irregularities. Can you tell us what the wisdom was at that time and kind of what you dug into?
Sure. A friend of mine who had been a poll watcher for Obama called and said, how did the election district in Harlem, in which he was the poll watcher, do? How did Obama do in that district? So I went back and checked by election district, something we usually don't do because it's not really necessary. We look at the larger assembly or congressional districts. And I said to Gordon Davis, who was the poll watcher and a former parks commissioner, my God, don't ever be a poll watcher for me. Hillary Clinton carried that district 141-0. And we both agreed that couldn't be, that had to be some sort of error, clerical or otherwise. And then I got hold of the Board of Election lists and discovered that there were somewhere near 80 districts in which Obama had not gotten a single vote. It just didn't seem possible, and I figured it was worth further investigation.
So what did you find out?
Well, I found out that most of that appeared to be clerical error. Why there was exactly a pattern that seemed to work against Obama as opposed to the other candidates, there are any number of explanations for that. One is that the way the ballot was constructed, his name was all the way over on the right, and Mrs. Clinton was first, followed by Bill Richardson and Joe Biden, candidates who for the most part did receive zero, and perhaps by 9:30, 10 o'clock at night, weary election inspectors or police civilians who were transcribing the results just kept writing zeros and didn't stop when they got to Obama.
You, in fact, put some hard numbers in your article talking about how in a Harlem district where it was 141-0, the vote now stands, and this was at the time of your article, at 261-136.
That's true.
So as these votes were reevaluated, was there any move by either camp to challenge what had gone down in the record books?
No, well, you've got to remember that New York has a history of confusion, incompetence, and even occasional corruption when it comes to the voting process. Gordon Davis did say that, and he was the Obama poll watcher, was kind of skeptical. He said that, well, first it was reported 141-0, now it's 261-136, and then he pointed out this is an assembly district that went 12,000 for Barack Obama to 8,000 for Clinton. So he said, I was watching like a hawk, but how did I know the machine had a mind of its own? Gordon Davis comes from Chicago, so he knows what it's like to for the machines to have minds of their own. But there wasn't any real sense that corruption had taken place or that the election was fixed. In fact, one person who worked for the Obama campaign, who's very familiar with New York politics, said, these people don't fix elections like this that don't count, a presidential election. They care much more about district leader or assembly elections where they do have a much bigger stake.
Now, the State National Democratic Committee did its own audit of sorts, and one of the issues that also came up is what happened to independents. Some people, you know, may have wanted to vote as Democrats, but maybe they were registered as independents. Was that a factor?
That was definitely a factor, not so much in these non-counting, but in terms of affidavit ballots and people who got to the polls and discovered they weren't registered or didn't appear to be enrolled as Democrats. A lot of people said, philosophically or ideologically, we don't like either of the parties, we're going to be independent, and then never enrolled in a party. And on primary day, on February 5th, when they got to the polls, they discovered they were not listed in the Democratic rolls. And in New York, you've got to be enrolled in a party in order to vote in that party. Primary. So they were not allowed to vote, and many of them were upset. Many of them may have forgotten that they had enrolled officially as independents and not within a particular party, and it caused a great deal of frustration, undoubtedly. And if those independents had registered as Democrats, probably a larger number of them would have been voting for Obama.
Sam, I'm going to ask you to stick around while we bring in a Harlem voter, Sandra Richardson. Sandra, how are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
I'm great. Now, tell me about your district, where exactly it is, and why it was important for you to go out and vote.
I belong to District 5, and I wanted to, you know, make sure that I voted because I wanted to make sure Obama's vote counted that day.
Where's District 5? Give me an intersection. I used to live in New York City.
135th and Broadway.
Okay, 135th and Broadway, so in the center of Harlem. And so when you saw Obama didn't receive any votes in the initial results, what did you think?
I was concerned because he should have had at least one, which was mine, and they were saying he had none.
And, you know, what happened when you went to vote in the primary?
The first thing that happened is when I went in, normally, you know, you're registered in the book that they have, and they seem to could not have found my name, first off. So in light of the fact of my name not being in the book, they told me I had to use the absentee ballot in order to have my vote registered. So I used the absentee ballot thinking that would be counted, and then, like I said, come to find out, they were saying he didn't have any vote.
Did you feel initially that casting an absentee ballot was going to, did you fear that it was going to put your vote at risk just to cast an absentee ballot as opposed to a regular ballot?
I did, because when I voted the last time, I didn't feel that my vote was counted either.
Now, do you know if the vote actually did count in these revised versions? Do you have any sense, Sandra, of whether or not your vote counted in the end?
No.
Sam, what about that? Do you think that her vote was counted in the end?
Well, I think, frankly, that it probably was counted. It's very important to remember, and the Board of Elections keeps reminding us of this, that the count on election night is a very, very unofficial, informal count. It's done for the convenience of the press and, obviously, by extension to the public. But then, under the law, the Board of Elections conducts its official canvass, which may take weeks. It involves the count from the back of the machines, which certainly would have corrected those clerical errors in the first count. And then to that, they add the absentee ballots, and to that, they add the affidavit ballots. People probably like Sandra, who showed up at the polls and they couldn't find a registration, but she swore on a ballot that she was, in fact, entitled to vote, and therefore they gave her an affidavit, and it presumably counted. So again, it doesn't instill much faith in the process for sure, and it shows how haphazard it can sometimes be, but it is a reminder that those votes that come out on election night or primary night are unofficial ones.
Sandra, were you, when you had this experience, when you went to the polls and you had to file an absentee ballot, did you then go around and talk about it with your friends and your neighbors? And what kind of conversations did you have about it?
I found out that several other people had the same problem, where their names weren't listed in the book and we've been voting there for years. And now all of a sudden they couldn't find our registration and we were forced basically to use the absentee ballot.
And did people talk about, for example, talking to a city council person, or did you just say, well, you know, this is too bad and I don't know what to do about it? What action did you specifically take afterwards, if any?
We didn't. We just kind of felt a little upset about it, and then we waited to hear what the outcome would be. And then once we heard that, you know, he had no vote for Harlem, then we at that point felt that, you know, our initial response was that it wouldn't be counted is what happened.
Sam, we asked the New York City Board of Elections to respond to the story, and a representative said that the issues were, for the most part, people showing up to the wrong polling place or voters not being properly registered for the primary, some people changing their names and not reporting a name change. And so looking, you know, from a 1,000-mile-up perspective, do there need to be some changes, you think, that make things easier for voters to understand how they need to register, whether it's on a party level, whether it's, you know, all of these other issues of name and address? Is that part of the problem?
Well, I think there are two problems. One is the public needs to be better educated and informed, that's for sure. And the rules, as we've seen with people closely following the contests in many different states this year and the end of last year, show there are different rules in different states. So people may not be familiar with the rules, when you have to register, how late you can change parties before the primary, things like that. The other problem, as Mayor Bloomberg in New York correctly points out, is that the Board of Elections is about the last vestige of formal patronage left in New York. It is very much controlled by the Democratic and Republican political organizations, has resisted for any number of reasons anything resembling efficiency or competence, and you've got a number of officials there trying to do their best against a system that just doesn't generate efficiency and productivity and great competence, frankly. And I think that's one of the big problems that New York voters have always had to face.
Sandra, if you were going to give some advice to someone who's going to vote either in one of the upcoming primaries or just in the general election in November, what would you say?
Actually, I'm not really sure. I was going to ask for some advice because I was concerned, like I said, with the fact that my name not being in the book. Is there something that I need to check to find out, retrace, you know, in order to find out what went wrong?
Sam, we have very little time, but what advice would you give?
I think that's a very good idea. I think you should call the Board of Elections and make sure that you are enrolled. And if they can't do that over the phone, then ask them to send you an enrollment form so you can re-enroll to make sure that for November you won't have any trouble voting at all.
All right. Well, both of you, it's been great talking. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We've been talking to Sam Roberts, urban affairs correspondent for the New York Times, and Harlem voter Sandra Richardson. This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. Today we digest some startling numbers on suicide rates for African Americans. The most recent numbers from the American Association of Suicidology show that suicide is the third leading cause of death among black youth after homicides and accidents. And while whites may be twice as likely as African Americans to complete suicide, the rate of suicide is growing faster among African American youth than the rate among whites. Today, as part of our series on mental health, we'll talk about these disturbing trends with Dr. Alvin Poussant. He's a professor of psychiatry at Judge Baker Children's Center and Harvard Medical School in Boston. He co-authored Lay My Burden Down, Unraveling Suicide and the Mental Health Crisis Among African Americans. Also with us, Donna Barnes. She's the president and co-founder of the National Organization for People of Color Against Suicide. Dr. Poussant and Donna, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
So, Dr. Poussant, let me start with you first. I understand there was a significant increase in suicides among African Americans between 1980 and 1995. Tell us about those statistics.
Well, I think the spike was mostly among young black men, 15 to 24 years of age. Way back in the 1950s, the rate was like about 5, and now it's up to like 12.2, and it kind of peaked up, went very high during 1990 and the year 2000. So that was of some concern that that is the reasons for the peak at that age, except there's no clear explanation for it, but it's a warning sign that, like a lot of other things and going on with black people, that young black males in particular are under a great deal of stress and are suffering from depression and feeling useless and helpless, and many are deciding to take their own lives. And not, there used to be a strong taboo in the black community about taking your own life, which I think now is disappearing, even though people don't like talking about suicide. On the other hand, among black women, the rate has been pretty steady and is rather low. The black male rate is about close to 5 times the rate among black women.
Do we know if these increases that we saw between the 80s and 90s are continuing today, or have things leveled out a bit?
Well, they've leveled out. I don't know what they are at the moment because there's a delay in getting the statistics, but they were highest in 1990 and the year 2000, and then 2000. In 2003, 2004, they dropped a little bit.
Well,
still remain quite high.
You mentioned that, you know, the feelings of just hopelessness are, you know, suicide, obviously, and hopelessness are very much related. Why specifically do you think young Black men would be in that position of feeling that things were so desperate, there was no reason to go on at all?
Well, I think a lot of things, you know, going on, there's so many, it's kind of multi-layered. You may have more young men under stress in the Black community. We have more single-parent homes in the Black community than ever before, like 70% of homes. Many of these young men are having trouble navigating the system. Just very huge high school dropout rates of over 50%, sometimes 75%. High rates of incarceration, you know, up like close to 9 to 10 times what it was in the 1950s. And the Surgeon General lists incarceration itself as a risk factor for committing suicide. And then with all the dilemmas that go with being an inmate, not being able to make it, leads to a lot of stress and depression. The violence in the Black community leads to a lot of stress and depression and post-traumatic stress disorder symptoms. All of these add up, but we know that the most likely cause of most depression, of most suicides, is chronic depression and other mental illnesses. So I think all of them are kind of combining to lead to this fatal symptom. Of many of these young men deciding, well, I'll just take myself out. And sometimes they do it via homicide, too, I might say.
Well, let me bring Donna into this conversation. You were personally affected by this issue. Tell us what happened to your son.
My son was away at school, and he actually took his own life in 1990 during the period that Dr. Passant was talking about, that the rate had increased substantially. And I had no idea that he had these thoughts of suicide, of course, being away from him. But when I look back at it, there's a possibility that he might have been suffering from either situational depression or some form of depression, because I can remember how he might have had disturbed sleep. I could call him in the afternoon at his dorm, and he would be sleeping and maybe not in class. So he wasn't concentrating on his studies. He probably wasn't sleeping that well. I do remember some bouts of anger, which are symptoms of depression, and me not knowing that those were symptoms left me in the dark. So when I got the phone call that he was missing from his dorm room, I mean, there's a whole story behind that, but when I got the call, I was shocked. I had no idea what suicide was all about. I had no idea what I was just totally taken by surprise. If someone had told me that my son was thinking of suicide, I would have told him that they didn't know what they were talking about, because he seemed like a very happy-go-lucky child. He smiled all the time. He was always telling jokes. He was always trying to make people feel comfortable in his presence. And so I think he might have had what we call masking suicide or laughing depression, where you hide it. Mm-hmm. And you don't show it and you don't share it with people, because oftentimes young kids, they don't really understand what they're going through. They don't understand why they cannot function, why they cannot participate in school like they're supposed to, because they don't get it. They don't get that they're suffering from depression. They don't have that knowledge. So it's important for us to educate communities and educate parents so that they'll know and they can help their child through these periods that they're going through.
Now, it must have been an incredible shock to you to find out, first of all, that your son was dead, and secondly, that he'd taken his own life. And so when you found that out, what kind of resources did you have to deal with your own grief and to be part of a community of people who knew what you were going through? Did you know where to turn?
Absolutely no. I had nowhere to turn. I did not know where to go. There was nothing within my community. I would ask people if they knew of someone who suicided, if this ever happened in our community before. Maybe when I was a kid, did it ever happen? People would say, no, we've never heard of anyone taking their own life. I had nobody to talk to, and I had to go outside of my community to find a support group. And even when I was there, I was the only black person in attendance. And I knew that the rates had gone up because after my son took his own life, I started reading everything I could. And there was nothing in the bookstores, so I'd have to go to the library. And all of that has changed now. Now you can go into a bookstore and find some information on suicide. And so I read everything that I could, and I found out that the suicide rate had increased substantially. And so that disturbed me that the black community was totally in the dark and knew nothing about it.
Well, I want to set the stage for people who are just tuning in. You're listening to NPR's News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea, and we're talking about suicide rates among young African Americans. We've got Dr. Alvin Poussant of Harvard Medical School and Donna Barnes of the National Organization for People of Color Against Suicide. Donna, in a second, I want to ask you about how you started your organization, but Dr. Poussant, first off, if there is someone who finds themselves in the position of having lost a loved one to suicide, where should they start to turn?
Well, I think they should look for support groups. I think the black community, because of NABCOS, or Donna Barnes organization, is becoming more aware of suicide, and they're breaking the silence about suicide. And also there's a lot of educational programs to increase the awareness of people and families about the symptoms of depression. So I think in a lot of community health centers and so on, you can find support groups. If they don't have support groups, then people should get support groups for people who have lost loved ones, even from other medical illnesses, but particularly from suicide, because there's so much guilt on the part of survivors. Frequently, they're asking themselves, what could I have done to prevent the suicide? Am I the reason that the person committed suicide? So they go through a particular unique form of grief. And so support groups in community health centers and hospitals and clinics, sometimes they're not all black, but that's okay. But you can find one, particularly those connected with mental health centers and mental hospitals.
Donna, how did you go about, I mean, starting any kind of organization is incredibly daunting. And so how did you go about starting the National Organization for People of Color Against Suicide?
Well, I became outspoken about suicide after losing my son. And the Boston Globe did an article on myself and my story, and it was on the front page of a Sunday paper. And because of that, I was getting phone calls from other people who were in the same situation that I was in. And one particular woman, Lois Delafaro, had experienced a suicide among her son. And she was wondering what we could do. Can we do something? And I knew of two other people who lost sons also, Doris Smith in Atlanta and Les Franklin in Denver, Colorado. And I contacted them and asked them if they would go out to Teaneck with me and spend a day with some of the families who have lost someone to suicide. And we did that. And we figured just a few people would show up. And there was standing room only. About 35 to 40 people showed up. And it wasn't just the families. It was the funeral director who buried the children, because there were several children in the Teaneck area who had died by suicide that particular year.
And in New Jersey, Teaneck, New Jersey.
Right, Teaneck, New Jersey. There were teachers. There was lawyers. Many people who were influential in the community showed up at that conference, and we decided that they were hungry for information and perhaps we should form an organization and do this on an annual basis, and that's what we did, and that was in 1998, and we've been around for 10 years now.
What are some of the things that inspire you to keep going? Because, you know, there must be so many people who you've touched over time.
Well, believe me, this is something that I did not dream I'd be doing, and I'd love so much to get out of it. But I keep getting calls. I mean, we have a support group at Howard University at the Mental Health Clinic for families who have lost someone to suicide. And I've been doing that for 5 years. And it gets, you know, tiring, but you keep getting calls. Unfortunately, my support group is growing and growing and growing. And this is so unfortunate. I'd like to see a time when NABCOS is no longer needed because we're doing the things that we're supposed to do in the community and everybody is educated and the rate is going down. But I'll be doing this until we're not needed anymore.
Dr. Poussant, you wrote a book with Amy Alexander called Lay My Burden Down, and both of you, you and Amy Alexander, lost brothers to suicide. What was it like, you know?
Well, not exactly. I called my brother a slow suicide.
Mm.
Amy and I's brothers had almost exactly the same history, being heroin addicts. They both had a psychotic break, which was diagnosed as schizophrenic. They both had been incarcerated, and that were doing into a lot of self-destructive behavior. Amy's brother actually did directly commit suicide by jumping off the building. My brother died from an injection, not quite an overdose, but he got acute meningitis.
So what
injection you're, needed, and he died.
What you're saying is that
slow suicide.
That he essentially gave up on life. He didn't commit suicide in a traditional sense, but he had just kind of.
Yeah, he was on a downward kind of a downward path. And I devalued his life, and that's one of the elements in suicide, is a person devalues their life, kind of feels worthless, so they're doing a lot of high-risk types of things that may lead to their death.
When you take into account that that's one way that people, you know, they may not put a gun to their head, but they do seek death in a sense. The problem is probably much larger than even the statistics would indicate.
Definitely. We don't know, for instance, how many overdoses of drugs among young black men, and it's very high. How many of them are suicides, in fact? They don't get counted as suicides. They get counted as an accidental overdose of injection drugs, usually. How many young men who put themselves in situations where it's very likely that they're going to get shot to death are actually committing suicide? There is such a thing as what we call victim-precipitated homicide, which is a suicide. The most classic example would be suicide by cop, which you read about in the newspaper from time to time, where people wanted to be shot to be killed because they were suicidal, but they didn't want to do it themselves. And sometimes they don't want to do it themselves because there's still a stigma attached to committing suicide, so they rather have someone else kill them or have it seem like an accident that they really didn't want to do it, but yet they were suicidal.
Donna, just in closing, if there's someone listening right now who is considering suicide, as your son considered and went through with it, what would you say to them?
I would say to them to please tell somebody. Tell an adult. Tell somebody so that they'll know that they're going through it and ask for the help, because nobody wants to die. Absolutely no one wants to die. They just want the pain to go away. And we as adults and parents need to know that they're suffering from pain, and that, you know, you shouldn't make a permanent decision for a temporary problem. So please tell someone that you're thinking of it, or call 1-800-273-TALK. That's 1-800-273-TALK. That's a national crisis line where they can get help.
Well, I want to thank you both so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We've been talking with Donna Barnes, the president and co-founder of the National Organization for People of Color Against Suicide. She joined us from our headquarters in Washington, D.C., and also Dr. Alvin Poussant, professor of psychiatry at Judge Baker Children's Center and Harvard Medical School in Boston. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. It is time now for a look at the week in sports with our very own Tony Cox. Hey, Tony.
Hey, Farai. So, have you seen this month's edition of Vogue magazine?
You mean the one with me on the cover? No, absolutely.
Well, it's the cover that's getting all the attention. The latest Vogue features a photograph of NBA superstar LeBron James and supermodel Gisele Bündchen. It's the third time that a male and the first time a black male has ever been featured on the cover of that magazine. And this cover is one folks are really talking about. So let me introduce our sports bloggers who are here to tell us just what the fuss is all about as we kick off this week's roundtable. We have D. Will. He writes for the blog Sports On My Mind. Chad Brown blogs for Alpha Blog Sports. And Jamel Hill writes for ESPN. Hey, everybody. Welcome to the show.
Hello, Tony. How you doing?
Hi, how you doing?
Doing great, thank you. So let me briefly describe this photo. Before I do, by the way, let me let you listeners know that you can see the cover posted on our website at newsandnotes.org. So back to the photo. LeBron James is there in shorts and a sleeveless top. It's his own line of sportswear, by the way. Bouncing a basketball with one hand, and in his other arm is supermodel Gisele Bündchen, wearing a strapless green dress. Now, LeBron sort of looks like, well, that's the issue, isn't it, Jamel? What does he look like to you?
Well, he looks beastly. You know, he's gnarly. He looks very angry. And then, you know, she sort of looks like, hey, I'm on my way to a great party or a high-class affair. And he just looks like kind of an animal. And if anyone has studied on the history of King Kong or seen any of the imagery that was from the movie posters, I'm talking about the old ones, you know, from the 30s and stuff, this picture looks exactly like a huge percentage of the pictures they used to put out about King Kong. And, in fact, a reader, after I wrote a column about it, sent me a photo that's even closer to the one that we have up on our website on ESPN.com, where the woman, I guess who's supposed to be Faye Ray, the damsel, is wearing the exact color dress that Gisele has on. And because everybody was saying, oh, well, Faye Ray used to be in white. Well, in this poster that I have, she is wearing the exact same color, and it looks, the photo looks identical, like a total snapshot from the 30s. And I just had a huge problem with the image it presented. And, you know, people have to keep in mind that Vogue has been around for about 115 years. LeBron is the first black male on the cover, the third male, period. And it's funny how when you go back and look at the other men who have been on the cover, I believe it was Richard Gere and George Clooney, they sure look a whole lot different than LeBron looks right now.
Well, let me bring the other guys in to talk about it, because first, the talk both online and on air, D. Will, I'm going to come to you first, this week on sports radio about this brouhaha has been mixed. Some people, white and black, say, get over it. There's nothing wrong with this photo. Others, again, black and white, say, I see how this could be offensive. And Vogue and LeBron, you should know better. So is it the way LeBron looks, how Gisele looks, how they look together, or is it just because he's black and she's white, D-Will?
Well, I don't think color has anything to do with it. If
really?
If Gisele were black, it would be considered a black-on-black crime, so to speak, with LeBron in the same pose as a King Kong, the same King Kong-type pose. I feel that it only exacerbates the issue that Gisele Bündchen is white. However, I don't see any difference between it's LeBron James's pose that is the center of this controversy, and that he is the first black man to be on the cover of American Vogue. The clothes that he's in, the nature of the article itself, which is about heavenly bodies, yet his body is not really shown. He's in loose workout clothes as opposed to Gisele being in a form-fitting dress. So his body isn't even the beauty of his body is not depicted in that photo.
One more thing on this topic before we move on. We're not going to spend the whole day talking about this, Chad. And it's, this is it. Two things. How much should LeBron be expected to be conscious of the implications of this photo? And I say that because LeBron, who was in his early 20s and is already a big-time businessman, has come out in defense of the photograph, saying that he likes it, that he's just showing a little bit of emotion. So shouldn't that be case closed?
Well, you have to remember, LeBron has been quoted as saying he wants to be an international icon before being a world champion. So it's quite possible that that's why he doesn't have a problem with it. For my own take, I'm more offended by the lack of originality. It'd be more interesting if LeBron was made to look runway ready and Gisele was made to look ready to take it to the hoop. I mean, I'd be interested to see what the response would be from that.
All right, well, let's move on to another topic because we have a couple of other things to get to. We want to talk about basketball more in just a moment. But first, let's go to baseball because the new season started this week and the game's greatest hitter finds himself without a team. Last year, at the age 42, Barry Bonds had 28 homers to go along with a 276 batting average and a 480 on-base percentage that still makes him a dangerous hitter who, if healthy, could contribute to a team's offense. Now he says he wants to play another season, but no team, publicly at least, Jamel, has shown any interest in taking him. So how can that be? Oh, yeah, did I forget to mention that he was also under indictment for perjury and obstruction of justice?
Well, I think most of the owners are kind of looking at this from the perspective of he's going to bring a lot of headlines. He's going to bring more than likely a lot of negative attention. I think they're looking at it very short-sighted because, as you quoted his batting average, there are a lot of teams that can use those stats even now. And you also look at the fact that regardless of how people feel about Barry Bonds, they come to see Barry Bonds. He's an instant park filler. And so they're missing sort of the economic advantages, I believe, and focusing too much on the perjury. And I know that may sound ridiculous, but in this sense, that trial is probably not going to happen this year. So they wouldn't even really have to worry about it. I mean, sure, he's going to be asked about it in every turn. It will be, bring some tension to the clubhouse, but overall, I thought that he handled that pretty well his last year in San Francisco. So to me, if you feel like you still need a certain amount of home runs, you still need someone to fill seats in the park, I think it's a pretty good mix. But obviously a lot of the owners, they don't see it that way. I know people have accused him of collusion. I wouldn't say collusion as much as I would say sort of everyone looking at the same picture and deducing the same thing, that they feel like he's not worth the trouble.
Well, D-Will, do you think that there, perhaps you follow baseball closely, do you think that there may be talks taking place secretly somewhere involving Bonds?
Actually, no, I don't think so. And I do find that collusion, I think collusion is a perfect reason for this happening, actually. The main complaint about Barry Bonds is that he will bring a circus-like atmosphere to the clubhouse. The media creates that atmosphere, not Barry Bonds. It's not as if he's calling up media members and asking them to show up to his Barca lounger in the clubhouse. So that's a media creation that's put onto Barry Bonds, that's given as an excuse for him not playing or not being able to play, that he will, wreck a clubhouse. I think that's a specious claim, and I think the owners are using that type of claim to say that he shouldn't be in our clubhouse.
So, Chad, is this the end for Barry Bonds?
I'd like to think not. He can still play, and he's still a draw. I was in Boston when the Giants came and played the Red Sox back in June, and the place was swarming with people to see him. So he can still be a draw, and he can still play. So it may end up that he may end up being somewhere like Tampa, but I think he can still find a home. It may not be what he wants, but he should be able to find someplace.
All right, let's jump back from baseball back to basketball. Chris Webber announced his retirement yesterday. The 35-year-old power forward had been on the roster of the Golden State Warriors for the second time in his career. And at his press conference, he said his, quote, wheels fell off, end quote. I want to mention Webber because it seems sad in a way how his career has ended. Here was one of the shining lights of his era, rookie of the year, a major member of the Fab Five at Michigan, a double-double scorer and rebounder, a great talent marred by injury who never got a ring, ended up playing on five different teams, drafted by Orlando, then went through Golden State, Washington, Sacramento, Philly, Detroit, and finally back to Golden State. What's his legacy, Jamel? Is he going to make it to the Hall of Fame?
Well, I like to think that he would, because his career numbers still look pretty good. And, you know, he was still on two pretty competitive teams, being in Sacramento and Detroit. But I think, you know, he just will be remembered, unfortunately, as the guy that just never quite got there, that just couldn't get the right mix. You know, he missed the title, obviously, when he was with the Fab Five. He missed the title when he was with Sacramento, could never get over the hump there, and he missed again in Detroit. And so, unfortunately for him, and then, of course, everybody knows about the timeout, I think his failures will always be sort of played up more so than his accomplishments, which is a real shame because as a power forward, he was a really dynamic player, a very smart player, a great passer, added a lot to his team. But I think there just will always be, and probably justly so, a segment that questions exactly how much heart he truly had in crunch moments.
You know, there are a lot of great players who never made it to the championship. Charles Barkley, Karl Malone, Patrick Ewing, Reggie Miller, the list goes on. And now we can add the name of Chris Webber to that list, Chad. But somehow, along the lines of what Jamel is saying, he seems different than those guys, doesn't he?
Yeah, he definitely does, because it seemed that not winning a championship, it wasn't that he didn't want it, but it was not necessarily the end of the world. And in light of those names you mentioned, Karl Malone, Charles Barkley, those guys made it to the finals. Unfortunately, Chris Webber didn't. Whether you're going to put that all on him, I think would be unfair, but he didn't. But I remember Chris Webber simply for introducing me as a fan to the Sacramento Kings, because until he got there, I only knew of Sactown as a line in California knows how to party. I mean, basketball then was just Lakers. The California basketball to me was the Lakers. And he, Vlade, White Chocolate, and Bibby and Doug Christie were amongst those, and of course Stojakovic were amongst those who brought it to the forefront. Now, they didn't get over that hump, unlike the Colts, who had a similar hump against the Patriots in football terms. But I mean, Weber is kind of like, he's one of those somewhat tragic figures, but he still put up great numbers. I mean, his career was not a loss by any means.
No, it wasn't. And had it not been for that famous shot by Robert Horry at the buzzer, that knocked them out of the finals about 6 years ago. So it's too bad how that has come to an end. We had another topic we wanted to talk to, so I'm going to talk about, but I'm going to ask you guys to hold on to it because we will revisit it. It has to do with the NFL wanting to come out and is considering a rule about how long your hair can be under your helmet. Unfortunately, the time has run short for us, so we can't do that. But I can ask you this in the 30 seconds that I have left. Your final four picks. Who do you think, Jamel? Really quickly.
One of mine is already knocked out, but I had Georgetown in the final four. But the rest, I believe I have UNC, and I do have Memphis. So, which pains me because they're playing my alma mater this weekend, Michigan State.
Guys, we ran out of time. We'll have to rely on Jamel's picks, and we'll talk to you after next weekend.
That's terrible. Well, I feel confident with that.
D. Will writes for the blog Sports On My Mind. He joined us from Radio VPR in Vermont. Chad Brown for Alpha Blog Sports joined us from our New York studios. Jamel Hill, ESPN.com, on the phone. Thanks, everybody.
That was NPR's Tony Cox. Now to the land of letters. Joining me to sort through all your mail is producer and editor Christopher Johnson. Hey, Christopher.
Right, Chidea, what's the deal? How you feeling?
I am feeling great. So what's up first?
Well, you know, we've been talking a lot about Detroit's Mayor Kwame Kilpatrick. He's been in a mess of trouble lately over a so-called text messaging scandal and the subsequent allegations of a fat payoff to cover up the whole thing. Eric Brown blogs for the Detroit News, and he's had some choice words for Motown's embattled leader.
This is a situation that has gone on far too long. I think he's at a point right now that he cannot effectively run the city of Detroit. His credibility definitely is shot, and I think it would be in his best interest to do the Elliot Spitzer and walk away.
Well, slow down there, Eric. Listener Kayfing Moore isn't trying to hear any of that walk away talk when it comes to his city's mayor. Kayfing wrote us to say this. All of the bloggers you have commenting about the story are reporting the corporate viewpoint on the situation. The brother from the Detroit News, who says he's from Detroit, offers the same suburban corporate report on the city. He makes mention about the crime and other negatives in the city. He doesn't mention the progress our city has made under the leadership of Mayor Kilpatrick. Under his leadership, downtown Detroit is now a pleasurable place to visit once again. In addition, the neighborhoods, for the first time in decades, are being redeveloped during one of the worst economic periods in this city's history.
And last week, we talked about the complicated history of black patriotism. We got a couple of letters on that one, including a note from Anita Fuaz. She wrote in to tell us she was disheartened by our story. Anita says, the guest as well as the host seem quite clearly to say that black Americans can be proud of this country only because the country has made progress in how America treats blacks. True patriotism involves caring about your country as a whole and wanting to make it better in every respect. By focusing solely on that treatment, horrible as it may be, the program implies that, in fact, blacks are not patriotic because they are not remotely interested in the country as a whole or the treatment of any other people in this country. That perception that black Americans care only about themselves weighs heavily in how other ethnic groups view black Americans. Well, Anita, thanks for that letter. We chose two guests who could speak to different aspects of the African-American experience, but there are more than two sides to the story, and we didn't choose a side.
And Edward Countryman teaches history in Dallas, and he wrote to weigh in on black patriotism. Edward says, in the long, miserable history of slavery, many people found their way to freedom while slavery itself continued. Most simply said, hooray, I'm free. But thousands of people gained freedom during American slavery's first breakup, during the Revolution. As far as I know, these were the first people in world history to think, now we are going to attack this thing. They are what made Frederick Douglass possible. They were exhibiting the very best thing about American history. Being white, I would not presume to tell black people what to think. But having such a heritage seems to me to be a pretty good reason to be patriotic.
And finally, listeners showing us some love, Debbie Maya describes herself as another white mid-aged fan. And she writes, I look forward to your show every night, Monday through Friday, on WFAE in Charlotte, North Carolina. Your staff and guests definitely invalidate any negative stereotyping. I love your show. Keep up the good work. Debbie, thanks for the letter. We promise to hold up our end of that deal if you promise to keep listening and keep on writing.
And that's it for letters, but please keep yours coming.
To write us, just log on to npr.org and click on Contact Us. When you get there, you'll see lots of shows to choose from. Make sure you pick News and Notes when you write to us, and be sure to tell us where you're writing from and how to pronounce your name. Christopher, thanks.
My pleasure, Farai.
That's our show for today. Thanks for sharing your time with us. To listen to the show or subscribe to our podcast, visit our website, nprnewsandnotes.org. To join the conversation or sign up for our newsletter, visit our blog at nprnewsandviews.org.